Hello, my name is Dorothea Salo, and I am Digital Repository Services Librarian at George Mason University. And this podcast is entitled Open Access for Teachers. Now, if you don't care to listen to the podcast, there is an associated paper which you can download from higheredblogcon.com. The pieces I am using underneath my scintillating voice are As I Figure and Midday Dance. Both of these are available from incompetech.com/royalty-free. Open access has existed for about 5 years as a movement, though the actual behavior of making research material free for all has been around for almost as long as we've had the internet. The open access movement emerged as a response to the enormous and frankly unsustainable price increases of the journal literature to academic libraries. Libraries basically sat back and they said, look, the people who are writing this material are giving it to the journals for free. They are not being paid. The people who peer review this material are not being paid. Frequently, the people who edit this material are not being paid. So why are the journals charging us outrageously to take material that they are not paying for and sell it back to us, when there is a distribution mechanism already available to us called the internet? Now, the precise definition of open access is debatable and certainly is debated. For the purposes of this paper, this podcast, I'm using the Budapest Open Access Initiative definition, which I will go ahead and read to you. By open access to this literature, we mean its free availability on the public internet, permitting any users to read, download, copy, distribute, print, search, or link to the full texts of these articles, crawl them for indexing, pass them as data to software, or use them for any other lawful purpose, without financial, legal, or technical barriers other than those inseparable from gaining access to the internet itself. The only constraint on reproduction and distribution, and the only role for copyright in this domain, should be to give authors control over the integrity of their work and the right to be properly acknowledged and cited. Now, researchers provide open access in two principal ways. They can publish their material in open access journals, of which there are quite a few these days. They can also self-archive papers in digital repositories. Now, there are several kinds of these. A digital repository that is maintained by the institution for which the researchers work is called an institutional repository, and that's what I do at George Mason University. I run an institutional repository. It is called the Mason Archival Repository Service, or MARS. Library consortia are also running repositories. The Washington Research Library Consortium runs a digital repository called Aladdin Research Commons. Individual disciplines, or third parties on behalf of individual disciplines, also run repositories. Possibly the most famous, and certainly one of the granddaddies of the genre, is Archive, which is a repository for primarily computer science, physics, mathematics, that kind of thing, which is run out of Cornell University. As yet, open access is catching on only very slowly. It is a very big change to the way that researchers are accustomed to disseminating their work. They don't necessarily understand all the advantages yet, and they're certainly not aware that libraries are having trouble paying for their work. Educators have been participating even less, and a lot of them think that, hey, this is a research thing, it's not our problem, it happens completely separately from us. The point of this paper and this podcast is to try to convince you otherwise, and to try to get you, as an educator, to participate in the open access movement. So the first question is open access really just for research, or can educators take advantage of it as well? Well, educators are certainly communicating over the internet just like everybody else, and educators are certainly creating digital materials. Frequently, this material will end up on a courseware site, courseware being WebCT, Blackboard, Desire to Learn, that kind of thing. What happens to this courseware when the course is over? Well, frequently it's rather ephemeral. It goes up on the courseware site, the students and the educators use it, and then when the semester is over, it's just taken down. However, educators want to reuse these materials, and not only reuse them, but pass them on to their colleagues, share them, just as researchers share the results of their work. So they're creating what are typically called learning objects. Now, a learning object can be anything from a syllabus, to a lesson plan, to a handout that you give students, to an entire unit, whatever. These learning objects can be collected, just as research papers are, in digital repositories. If you have an institutional repository at your institution, ask. Find out whether it also accepts learning objects. There are, however, also a number, and the number is growing, of digital repositories designed specifically for learning objects, with, for example, descriptive metadata that applies specifically to learning objects. If you're interested in this, Google for learning object, you will find more than you ever wanted to know. Some universities are making a concerted effort to make the learning objects that their educators create public. When did this start? Well, the granddaddy of the genre is MIT's Open Courseware Initiative that began in roughly 1999. Just a few days ago, as I record this, the United Kingdom's Open University announced receipt of a huge, huge grant to make, quote, a selection of its learning materials, unquote, publicly and freely available over the internet. There's been a little bit of debate about this. Some educators welcome the opportunity to offer these materials to learners who would not otherwise have access to them, seeing this as an opportunity for those learners. Others have been a little bit disturbed. They are afraid that making course materials openly available will be some kind of substitute for face-to-face education, the way that we're all familiar with it. The truth is somewhere in between. Of course, distance education has come about, become a force to be reckoned with, but nobody is saying that simple access to learning objects is sufficient to create a good learning environment. What has happened instead is that educators have found that circulating these learning objects is helpful to other educators. Innovative approaches, novel materials, useful new things can be circulated faster and more effectively than has ever been possible. And educators are also finding out that this can advance their careers. When a learning object that they create is available on the internet, it catches on, it's disseminated widely, it's used widely, well, that can be a big boost to your career. So learning objects are one way in which open access is taking hold in higher education. Another way is open access textbooks. Now, as I'm sure we're all aware, the price of college-level textbooks has been rising almost as fast as the cost of the journal literature. Why does this happen? Well, rapid republication cycles, expensive add-ons like CD-ROMs, roll. And students are complaining. Quite recently, the Virginia State Assembly passed a bill aimed at lowering textbook costs for higher education students. Open access presents another possible answer. The problem is that the economic model for textbooks is different for that of journals. Someone who writes an article for a journal does not get paid. What that person is hoping for is the boost to his or her career. Textbook authors, however, do not get much of a career boost, typically, from publishing a textbook, so they expect to be paid for it, and in fact, they are. Textbooks are also more expensive to produce than journals. They demand much more difficult typography, four-color printing, which is expensive. But the far more important cost for our purposes has to do with a much more punishing permissions climate, copyright clearance climate, for textbooks as opposed to journals. If you write a journal article, what do you have to do to stay good? Well, you have to cite everything you use. You need to not plagiarize. It's not that simple for a textbook. A textbook is a commercial item. So even something, say a picture of something from a museum, which you might think would be open access, no. That textbook publisher has to pay for it. So for every textbook that's published, that means you have to list everything that needs clearance, you have to find all the owners, you have to negotiate for royalties, and you have to pay those royalties before the book even sees print. This is expensive. Another problem is that electronic textbooks are just not catching on real well with students. You can't mark up the margins, you can't sell them back. Students are not terribly happy about them. Even so, there are some experiments in open access happening with textbooks. One example is the Amadeo Challenge. This is an invitation to physicians and medical researchers to publish open access textbooks in their fields, and they are especially emphasizing small and underserved medical specialties. Another notable experiment is Freeload Press, whose URL is completely predictable. Their website offers business and accounting textbooks free to learners who download the electronic version. Learners who want paper can get a paper copy of the book at a significantly reduced cost compared to a typical textbook. The future here is fairly murky, but it does bear watching. So now we've talked about three genres, I suppose we might say, of open access. Open access to research, open access to learning objects, and open access to textbooks. Now, what kinds of problems can these open access materials solve for educators? Well, there's something that's terribly, terribly obvious. If open access is widely adopted, it enables educators to connect their learners, all their learners, distance learners, classroom learners, everybody, with the best and most current research and teaching techniques that are available in their field. Now, to me, that's enough of a recommendation all by itself. However, there are other reasons for educators to support open access, and I'm about to talk about a few of them. A number of you are probably familiar with electronic reserves, or e-reserves, for those of you who aren't. An academic library scans an article or a book chapter and places that scan online for a particular class. Now, access to that scan is restricted and must be restricted for copyright reasons. Only the people who are in the particular class can access the material. This is typically, again, done through courseware. E-reserves are incredibly popular because they are terribly, terribly convenient. Print reserves at libraries that offer electronic reserves have dwindled almost to nothing. And academic libraries all over the place are purchasing all kinds of fancy new scanner hardware to handle the impressive workloads. Now, what makes e-reserves possible are some occasionally rather vague provisions of the United States Copyright Code, and I'm not even going to try to explain them. There have been attempts within libraries to create standard fair use guidelines for e-reserves. Those attempts have completely failed. Libraries are more or less on their own. They're doing their best to comply with the law as they understand it, but there is no legal precedent. Or at least the legal precedents are unclear and occasionally a little worrisome. Now, obviously, for articles that are open access, you don't have to worry about e-reserves. You simply create a link to the open access version of the article, and there is not a problem. Why would this be desirable when we already have e-reserves? Well, the fact is that e-reserves are starting to come under attack. In May 2005, the Association for American Publishers wrote to the University of California at San Diego. They demanded that the library, and I'm quoting here, take prompt action to investigate and terminate the illegal reproduction, display, and distribution of copyrighted works in the library's e-reserve system. Now, the library replied that, in its opinion, its system contains sufficient oversight to ensure that its e-reserves comply with applicable copyright law. If this sounds familiar, well, it's rather similar to what happened in the early 1990s regarding course packs. Basic Books versus Kinko's Graphics Corporation established pretty clearly that you cannot simply copy a whole lot of stuff and sell it at a fat profit to students. Now, libraries are not Kinko's. We have a few more legal protections. However, publishers are clearly worried about the impact of e-reserves on their royalties, just as they worried about copyrighted course packs. If they could figure out how to create a legal challenge along the same lines as the Kinko's challenge, they could get library e-reserve systems shut down forever, and that would presumably please them. Or would it? The interesting thing about the Association for American Publishers, as Sherlock Holmes said about the dog in the night, is that they've done nothing since. They have not opened any kind of legal proceeding against UCSD, and they have not asked to peer under the hood of any other university's e-reserve system. So what's going on here? Well, I don't work for the Association of American Publishers, but if I did, I might tell them this. Right now, open access is catching on very, very slowly among research faculty. If, however, the same research faculty, many of whom are also in classrooms, were to find their popular e-reserves programs threatened, they might start asking themselves, what's the alternative? Well, the obvious alternative is open access. So the AAP has to do some cost-benefit analysis. If open access is a greater threat to their business model than e-reserves can be, and keep in mind that e-reserve systems are run by libraries, which are historically very, very responsible and very careful and very knowledgeable about copyright law, then it may well behoove the AAP to just back off. And that does indeed seem to be what they have done so far. Still, if you are an educator and you are concerned about this, then the obvious way to hedge against it is to push open access as much as possible as a defense against losing that easy, convenient online access to research for yourself and your learners. Open access could also be useful to you if you teach distance education, whose growth and popularity have created significant challenges both for educators and for libraries. Distance learners may live very far away from the library of the institution they are nominally attending. They may be too pressed for time to come to the physical library. And some of them even encounter difficulties trying to get the right authorizations to use electronic materials from the institution that they're attending that institution has bought and paid for. Again, these access issues simply do not arise with open access materials. They're there on the internet, they're free for everybody to use, and a distance learner can get to them just as easily as anybody else. So open access is definitely a boon to the distance educator and the distance learner. So let's say you're sold, and you're asking yourself, okay, where do I go to find materials that have been made open access? Well, there are a number of useful starting places, and very quickly I will list a few of them for you. These are all in the paper, so you can go look up the URLs. The first is OAISTER, which is actually spelled O-A-I-S-T-E-R for reasons you absolutely do not want me to explain. It is a search engine for digital repositories. It's based at the University of Michigan, and a very, very useful place to start. For open access journals, there is a directory of open access journals at doaj.org. There is also a directory of open access repositories. It is called OpenDoor, and it is at opendoar.org. For learning objects specifically, there is the Multimedia Educational Resource for Online Learning and Teaching, otherwise known as MERLOT, at merlot.org. There is also EduSource Canada, www.edusource.ca. Finally, there is always Google Scholar, which does crawl digital repositories and open access journals to make their contents part of its index, and that is, of course, at scholar.google.com. Now, this is early days for open access. Coverage is very, very scattershot, and it's very likely you won't find what you're looking for. If you don't, search for the author's website if the author is still alive. A number of authors, unaware of the progress in open access and specifically of institutional repositories, are making their own work available on their own websites, which is great, but the material's a little harder to find and it's harder to distinguish from the riot of other things that are available on the web. And of course, these websites can disappear without notice and without recourse. Still, it's not a bad idea to take a look for the author and see if the author has made that information available. Finally, and this is my pitch to all of you, help make more materials open access. It helps you, it helps researchers, it helps learners, it helps everyone. How can you do that? Encourage your school to open an institutional repository if it does not already have one. Frequently, repository efforts are spearheaded by academic libraries. Get in touch with your librarians and ask if they're thinking about this and offer your support. Educate your colleagues about open access. Awareness is still very low. Awareness of the benefits is still very low. And there's been research that indicates that it takes 7 mentions of something like an institutional repository before a busy researcher or educator takes action. So please be as many of those 7 mentions as you can for as many researchers as you know. Useful starting points include Peter Suber's Open Access Overview and the Create Change website, which is at www.createchange.org. Encourage your colleagues to make their materials open access. Publish them in open access journals, self-archive them in a digital repository, self-archive them in a learning object repository. Ask your department and your institution to make formal statements in favor of open access. A number of universities have done this already. There's an excellent example at Cornell University. You can look in my paper for the URL. And a couple of more radical suggestions. If you're using your own research in your classes, don't send it to the e-reserve department. Please self-archive it instead. You will ensure continued access for yourself and your learners, you will increase the reach and the citation impact of your work, and you will benefit other researchers, educators, and learners worldwide. It is worth it. Please do it. And instead of putting a specific article on e-reserve, if you know the author, please contact them. Ask them to self-archive it. Say, hey, I'm using this article in my class. I would love for it to be open access. Your institutional repository, the URL is here. Please go self-archive it. That will help more than I can tell you. Open access is very, very important. It is too important to be left just to researchers and librarians, because it's educators and learners who often lose the most when research results and innovative teaching techniques get locked behind toll access firewalls. We all want more materials online, but for those materials to go online, all of us have to make the commitment to put them there. And that's really what open access is all about. Making sure that online access remains possible, remains convenient, remains inexpensive to educators and to learners, and remains viable in the long term. And that's really all I have to say to you today. I thank you very much for listening. This paper, Open Access for Teachers, from Higher Ed Blog Con. My name is Dorothea Salo, and my email address is dsalo@gmu.edu. Please feel free to get in touch with me if you have questions or concerns or ideas to help the furtherance of open access. Again, thank you very much, and have a good Higher Ed Blog Con.